We'll hear argument now in the case of Alexander against Unlimited Progress Corporation.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Christy Olson, and I represent the defendant, Unlimited Progress, doing business as CDAC. My appellant's argument this morning, Your Honors, involves count two of the plaintiff's complaint, which involves the section 1692C violation of the FDCPA. And the issue here is whether the district court's decision granting summary judgment for the plaintiff was correct when it is undisputed that the defendant had no actual knowledge that the plaintiff was represented by an attorney when the two collection letters were sent to her. And it was not until when the plaintiff's attorney called, did CDAC know that an attorney was representing the debtor. 1692C provides that the debt collector must have knowledge or must know that the debtor is represented by counsel and must be able to ascertain the name and location of that attorney. Here, only the creditor, almost 3 years before the letters were sent, had knowledge of the representation, and that was never shared with CDAC. The plaintiff and the district court applied an imputed knowledge standard to impose liability, but the statute does not provide for imputed knowledge. The statute uses the word to know, and it is our contention that the district court should have followed the plain language of the statute, and the district court did not. The Hubbard case provides that in order to establish the 1692C violation, the plaintiff must show two things. That prior to the letter being sent, the debtor was represented by an attorney with respect to that debt, and the defendant had actual knowledge that the plaintiff was represented by an attorney with respect to that debt. And the plaintiff did not establish that here. The plaintiffs rely on the FTC commentary, which states that the creditors, the creditor's knowledge that the consumer has an attorney is not automatically imputed to the debt collector. And the plaintiffs contend that that comment or statement indicates that there can be situations of imputed knowledge. And it is the defendant's contention that that statement says what it says. The creditor's knowledge is not automatically imputed to the debt collector, as is what happened in this case. Imputed knowledge is a concept that appears in agency, principal agency law, where an agent's knowledge is imputed to the principal. And that's not a situation we have here. First of all, we're not trying to impute the debt collector's knowledge back to the creditor. But more importantly, in most of these situations, there's no agency relationship between the creditor and the debt collector. These are primarily independent contractor relationships. So the concept of imputed knowledge wouldn't
I gather under the statute, if there were an agency relation, the whole statute wouldn't apply. Because the statute applies only to debt collectors, and an agent of the creditor would just be a creditor.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. I have no other points on this particular issue, and I would ask to reserve my time for the second issue, the bankruptcy preemption issue, unless the court has any further questions.
Certainly, Ms. Olson. Mr. Phillips.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm David Phillips for the plaintiff, the appellee in this matter. There are two issues for this court in this matter. One is the imputed knowledge issue. The second is the bankruptcy preemption issue, and that's probably the bigger of the two issues. It's also the same issue that's up before this court in the next appeal that we're arguing, Ms. Olson and I, and Randolph and Cross matters. I don't think under the facts at issue in this matter, imputing the knowledge of the creditor to the debt collector does any violence to the statute, it only happens in very limited circumstances, and there's adequate protection.
You know, the argument that you make here and in other cases is, look, this is a nitpicky statute. You got to take the language seriously. We follow the language literally. But now when that approach cuts against you, you say, well, let's not actually follow the language literally. Let's be flexible and so on. And why shouldn't we just follow the language literally no matter who wins and who loses?
Well, Judge, I don't think I've ever said it's a nitpicky statute. That's something the defendants say, the debt collectors say. I think that in this case, there's adequate protection already built into the statute under 1692K, where the debt collector gets to show that, hey, we had a procedure in place. It could be as minimal as we asked you, don't send us a bankruptcy account.
We're not worried about defenses. We're worried about the fact the statute says, if you know X, and they're apparently conceded here that the debt collector did not know X.
Right, and because...
Well, and why isn't that just...
Because I don't
the
think
end of the world here.
Because I don't think we should encourage debt collectors to bury their head in the sand and be deliberately ignorant by not even asking X.
Well, look, deliberate ignorance is a term of art. It means strongly suspecting something and then taking active steps to avoid gaining further knowledge. Is there any reason to believe that here the debt collector strongly suspected that Alexander had a lawyer and then took affirmative steps to avoid gathering further knowledge?
We never got to that because they didn't even bother to ask. We don't know what they did.
Is there any reason to believe that they strongly suspected that Alexander had a lawyer?
No, that was never developed below.
Then a deliberate ignorance argument is not available.
That's fine, Your Honor. That's
what deliberate ignorance means.
Your Honor, I'd rather move on to the preemption issue, which is the more important issue here. Because in the second two cases, this whole issue about imputed knowledge doesn't even arise because in the second two cases, the debt collectors both were on notice specifically of the bankruptcy. And as I said, the more important issue here is the preemption issue. And essentially what we have is district courts taking three different approaches. Yes, no, and maybe. One line of authority or views from the district court. What's that, Your Honor?
That about covers it.
Yeah. It's yes, no, or maybe. And I think if it's a yes, no, or maybe, just as in baseball, the tie goes to the runner. Here we have both plausible decisions by the district court that everything's preempted, nothing's preempted, some of the claims are preempted, and some of them are preempted.
I actually don't even see how anybody can talk about preemption. Federal statutes don't preempt other federal statutes. Preemption is a doctrine under the Supremacy Clause having to do with the relation between federal and state statutes. The concept for federal statutes is implied repeal.
I understand that, Your Honor. That's the phraseology they've been using below.
Right, but it's wrong, so let's talk about the correct phraseology.
Fine, Your Honor. We'll talk about the implied...
Actually, this circuit issued an opinion that is now only 7 days old saying... Just don't talk about preemption when you're talking about the relation between federal statutes. So here we are.
Sure. Well, in this case, we have two federal statutes that arguably could cover this conduct. You have the Bankruptcy Code with Section 1362, which is the automatic stay, and you have the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And as this court said in United States versus Palumbo, we generally try to give effect to both statutes if we can. And here, there is no conflict if you give effect to both statutes. We're not talking about an issue where we have to go into the bankruptcy court and ask for some unique determination, or we're fighting over the assets, or did somebody do something properly in the bankruptcy court, file something, not file something. We're talking about an extra layer of protection under the Fair Debt Act. And frankly, this decision, you know, it's a matter of first impression. This court didn't address it in Adair versus Sherman, didn't address it in Cox versus Zale, and the Supreme Court case that the defendants and the district courts rely on, Kokoska versus Belfort.
The particular language of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act was enacted when?
It was enacted before the bankruptcy, the current bankruptcy.
74 and the... I know, 362 is in 78.
I think it's 77 for the FDCPA and then 78 for the bankruptcy code.
Right. Okay, so it's 77 and 78. But in any event, it's the the debt statute is first and then the bankruptcy code.
Right. But there was a bankruptcy code before that. you know, but these statutes do not conflict on this point. In fact, the proof's in the pudding here. There was nothing in any of the cases that have gone through to judgment, Hyman versus Tate and Curlin, or this case of Alexander versus CDA, where anyone had to ask anything about what happened in the bankruptcy court. There's no issue about what's filed or not filed. It was by automatic, by matter of law, I filed it, and the implication then is you don't owe that debt anymore. Your estate owes the debt. You know, in Turner versus JBDB, we had a situation where the debt, you know, was discharged into bankruptcy, and this panel held that we stated a claim there that could be tried as to whether that created a false implication that somehow you still owe the debt despite the bankruptcy. And it's similar here. It's under 362. This gives a different layer of protection. Under the Fair Debt Act, you can get actual damages, statutory damages, and fees and costs. Under Section 362, you can get actual damages, fees and costs, and punitive damages. One of the distinctions is that you can't go after the creditor, as you've noted, under the Fair Debt Act, and you could go after the creditor under 362, but this isn't a case where there's any conflict. There's nothing being fought about as to the asset. And Kokoska versus Belford, there was a direct conflict. The U.S. Supreme Court case, it was, do we follow exemptions under the Consumer Credit Protection Act, or we look at the Bankruptcy Act? Here, that has nothing to do with anything. This isn't even an asset of the bankruptcy. This is a post-bankruptcy potential asset, and nobody's fighting over it. Just, is it a violation? Isn't it a violation? And I think under those circumstances, because you can reasonably say yes, no, or maybe, I think the answer has to be that there shouldn't be any sort of preclusion here. The Fair Debt claim can go ahead. You know, and as I said, the proof's in the pudding. There simply was no conflict here. There was no need for any interpretation of the bankruptcy code proceedings or the bankruptcy court's expertise. That's the phraseology that some of the district courts use. In fact, the complaints were carefully pled to not even allege any violation of the bankruptcy code. It just said, you know, client filed for bankruptcy. That created a reason why the debt was no longer owed. It'd be no different than the allegation being, I paid the debt, or you got the wrong guy, or you got the wrong amount. And like I said, there's no adjudication of the issue of the property, the bankruptcy estate, and unless there's any other questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Anything further, Ms. Olson? I'm sure there is.
I'd like to spend a few minutes, and then I hopefully won't repeat myself in the next argument. And I'm sure I've been equally sloppy using the word preemption as well.
As I say, the concept is implied repeal. And my question, therefore, is whether the standards of implied repeal have been met. There's no express repeal. Bankruptcy Code doesn't purport to displace any other statute.
Correct.
And the standard of implied repeal, as I understand the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, is the statutes are completely incompatible. You cannot obey one while obeying the other.
Well, in this,
there doesn't appear to be any incompatibility in that sense.
Well, Your Honor, I think there is on maybe one small nitpicky point, and this is brought out in the Hubbard decision I mentioned. In this case, if I could just make one factual statement, the plaintiff's complaint specifically says for the 1692 ENF violations, the defendant violated the FDCPA because you attempted to collect a debt that is subject to the automatic stay, which is Section 362. And as the Hubbard Court points out, if you allow the FDCPA violation here, or the cause of action, instead of requiring the debtor to use the bankruptcy code, you're writing out the willfulness language found in Section 362H.
And what's the problem with that? It's perfectly normal for Congress at different times to pass two statutes that provide different remedies with different requirements. You have a willfulness requirement under 362 and you get punitive damages. Mm-hmm. You have no willfulness requirement under the Debt Act and you get statutory damages. It looks like perfectly normal overlapping legislation.
Well, I think in this case, because the complaint specifically alleges the violation of 362, and because Congress has provided that remedy under 362 with specific language there, that should be controlling here, not only from a damages standpoint, from what to establish for a cause of action standpoint. And I find this court...
I don't understand it. I mean, for example, the telecommunications, as the Supreme Court said recently in the Verizon case, the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and the Sherman Act of 1890 may overlap with respect to the obligations of telecommunications carriers. You show one thing, antitrust violation, you get treble damages. You show a different kind of thing, you get fee access to the other network. The Supreme Court made it very clear in Verizon that these were two things, neither displaced the other, neither modified the other. They're just separate. They've got different requirements, overlapping remedies. Why is this any different? I think you would be saying something like, well, you can't use the Telecommunications Act to get access because then you wouldn't have to show what's necessary in antitrust, even though you have to show more in antitrust because you're getting treble damages.
Well, Your Honor's knowledge of the theory law is far greater than mine. But I would, if I could, think here that if you... 2 points, if I might. This court's decision in Cox, I think, is instructive on this, where the court recognized that if you have, or the debtor, or excuse me, the plaintiff has a remedy provided in the bankruptcy code, then the debtor goes to the bankruptcy court to get relief. And I believe that once the FDCPA exists for all consumers, but once a debtor has chosen to avail him or herself of the protections of the bankruptcy code vis-a-vis that person's creditors, I believe that that person is also subject to what remedies are provided in the bankruptcy code. And here, the bankruptcy code gives a very specific remedy under 362H to address this exact situation that we have here. So I believe that once the debtor makes that choice, the debtor takes all the protections that the bankruptcy code gives and might have to take some drawbacks that the bankruptcy code gives.
But then the parallel would be that if you file a lawsuit, if you're a telecom firm and you file a lawsuit, you have to elect between the Sherman Act and the Telecom Act. If you try to plead both, one of them somehow evaporates. What sense would that make?
I can only say that in this case, I don't think it's a question of picking a remedy under two separate statutes, where maybe you could have relief under both. For example, where you could have relief under both, but your burden of proof or your elements of cause of action may be different. Here is a situation where I think the Supreme Court's statements in the Kokoska case is important, and I realize that case was decided before the FDCPA was enacted, but the FDCPA is part of the Consumer Credit Protection Act that the court discussed, and the court said, look, the Consumer Credit Protection Act was designed to give the consumer protections so as to prevent the bankruptcy. That's what that act was designed to prevent. But once the bankruptcy occurred, or once the consumer filed for bankruptcy, then the bankruptcy, at that time, the act, takes over, and the remedy is provided under the act. And I think that analysis...
But the holding depended on a finding of incompatibility. You were going to have to do one or the other, but not both. They were incompatible. That's your standard repeal by implication package. And here, it doesn't look like incompatibility. It looks like cumulativeness. It's almost the opposite of incompatibility.
Well, I can only go back to the willfulness standard, which I believe is a standard under 362H, not only for punitive, but for finding whether the state has been violated. There's been mention made of the Turner case, which the court is very familiar with, and I just wanted to point out that this issue was not addressed in the Turner case when the court recognized the cause of action under 1692E in that case. I have nothing further and would save the rest of my comments for the next argument.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, and thank you very much. This case is taken under advisement.